to start with a story of our great beneficent original teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha. From the Vinaya collection of stories. Once upon a time, a certain monk was sick with dysentery, and he lay fouled in his own urine and excrement. As the Blessed One was going on his alms rounds with Venerable Ananda as his attendant, he came to that monk's dwelling. When he saw him lying where he was, he went up and said, "What is your sickness, monk?" "It's dysentery, Blessed One." "But, monk, have you no attendant?" "No, Blessed One." "Well, why don't the other monks not look after you?" "Well, I'm of no use to them, Lord. That's why they don't look after me. I'm just sick in bed and I'm not helping them, and they basically forgot about me." Then the Blessed One, the Buddha, said to Ananda, "Ananda, go fetch some water. Let us wash this monk." "Even so, Lord," the Venerable Ananda replied, and he brought some water. The Blessed One poured out the water, and the Venerable Ananda washed the monk. Then the Blessed One took him by the head, and Venerable Ananda took him by the feet, and they raised him up and put him on a bed. A wonderful and kind of rare story, actually, in all the stories of the Buddha, where he kind of, in a very practical way, helped take care of this sick monk, helped clean him up and put him back on the bed. Usually the Buddha's just teaching Dharma in some kind of dignified, clean way. So that's a wonderful story, I think, from the ancient tradition. Practically helping out someone in need. And then after this event, he summoned the assembly of monks and asked them, "Monks, is there a sick monk in a certain dwelling?" "There is, Blessed One." "What is that monk's illness?" "He has dysentery. "Has he anyone to look after him?" "No, Blessed One." "Why do you monks not look after him?" "Well, that monk is of no use to the monks. That's why they don't look after him. Why we don't look after him." And the Buddha said, "Monks, you have neither mother nor father to look after you. If you do not look after each other, who will look after you? Let those who would look after me look after one who is sick. If he has a preceptor, as a monk, his preceptor should, as long as he lives, look after him until his recovery. His teacher, if he has one, should do likewise. Or his co-resident, or his student, or one who has the same preceptor, or one who has the same teacher. If he has none of these, the Sangha should look after him. Not to do so is an offense of wrongdoing." That's why it's in the Vinaya, is the collection of precepts and forms for the monks. So this is one of the minor offenses, to not look after a sick monk. And I think it's a great story about Sangha. You know, the monks in Buddha's time literally would leave home, so they had no family they were living with anymore. So the Sangha became the family, and would look after them. And I think how this is a kind of natural response. Like right now, our friend Moni Bryan is in the hospital with a shoulder surgery, but then further complications, back to the hospital. His name Mani means myriad cures. And his myriad cures often come from the Sangha. So Lori and Hannah organized this round of attending to this ill practitioner. And very beautiful. People signed up and are going to visit him and are taking care of him. It's a great demonstration. You know, someone who lives alone, this is his family. Maybe we don't think of it, of doing such things until somebody is sick and the occasion arises, and then naturally there's a response. So, responding to suffering, wishing others and ourselves to be free from suffering, and then if the wish is there and it's possible to do something to help, like visit and take care of some practical things, then the action naturally arises from the wish. So, to review our exploration of loving kindness and compassion, like a lot of you have been here for previous talks, so to learn this thoroughly, let's see, do we remember what are the kind of opposites to, say, loving kindness? What's loving kindness the antidote towards, that completely, when loving kindness is present, it completely removes its opposite, or as the opposite cannot manifest at a, during a moment of loving kindness. Do anyone remember what that is?
Anger,
yeah. Anger. It's like the total opposite. And I appreciate the point that, like, when there's loving kindness, there can't be anger at the same time. You can't have kind of like a blend. I mean, we might want to argue that. But I think in any given moment, I think it seems true. In a moment of actual loving kindness, there's no anger there. And in a moment of anger, we've temporarily lost loving kindness. We might say, well, we really love this person in general, we just forgot. So in this moment, it's one or the other. And the so-called near enemy, or the mental state that seems like loving kindness, but actually is a little bit off track. You remember the traditional, what's that? That's for compassion. For kindness, loving kindness is loving with some kind of like attachment. True loving kindness, there's no like agenda, there's we don't want anything in return. So often these get mixed together. I really love this person, maybe means I'm actually like really attached to them. Maybe it's both, but we could say the attachment to the person kind of undermines the true loving kindness, partly because the attachment, if the attachment's there, then if the person does something against our liking, then it very quickly shifts from loving kindness into anger. Yes.
Just the question of mother love, which seems to have kind of a component of both. It has the I love you, and it also is very protective.
Yeah.
Probably say attack.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in this case they can go together, actually. Unlike anger and loving kindness, they can't be at the same time. I would say, looking at it experientially, that it seems like you could have the loving, like a true unconditional love, just total appreciation for the person, however they're manifesting, mixed with an attachment that likes them to manifest in certain ways. And, you know, that are appealing to me. You know, that would be the attachment part. And I think that, yeah, even with the mother, like, it's more pleasant when the child's being nice. But, so I think they could be at the same time, but then if the mother or any of us who are attached, want our true loving kindness, our metta, our Maitri to flourish completely, then we can see how we're off. We can kind of like see if we can release a little at a time, maybe the attachment. And then the love, sometimes I think you can maybe experience this where you do release a little attachment and you can feel the true love kind of grow actually and flourish. That's why they call it the near opposite, because it kind of undermines the true quality of loving kindness. So then we have compassion, and which is its opposite is. Do you remember this one? So loving kindness is like anger or hatred, and this one's very similar, but it's like cruelty. I think this is my understanding is that cruelty is kind of like actively causing suffering, right? So if compassion is the wish that others be free from suffering, its opposite is the wish to cause others suffering, whereas loving kindness is the wish that all beings are happy. Anger is just goes up against that. That's how it's put traditionally, and we could contemplate it. I see some wisdom in putting it that way, that cruelty or violence, you could even say, is like the opposite of the extreme opposite, right, of wishing others to be free from all suffering. And then the near opposite, like Nanette mentioned, pity is often listed, which is sort of like compassion, but it's kind of looking down. Oh, you poor thing. It's kind of a separation, looking down on a suffering one. And it's the problem is that it's this kind of separateness, and it's a little bit aloof. And another near opposite that's often listed is grief, interestingly. Compassion is actually empathy with others in their suffering, and it might include some kind of like sadness and really feeling their suffering. But grief, as I understand it, would be like, it's like we're getting lost in the in our own pain, to the extent that it's actually not helpful anymore, which is again a natural thing to happen. So I think it could be, again, just like you could have maybe attachment and true love at the same time. You maybe could have grief and true compassion at the same time, but the grief being really bogged down in our personal despair actually undermines, interestingly, the true compassion, which is the wish that they are free from suffering, and maybe even that we could even do something to help. Maybe that's part of like being in extreme grief might kind of paralyze us from being able to do anything. I think that's maybe part of it. Yes.
So there's another one. The subtle between being attached to and not expressing grief versus having a loss, having a way of expressing it, whether it's wailing, vary from culture to culture, but it's done in fullness and then passed on.
Yes.
The difference
is
that you wouldn't want to be in denial about it.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's true.
You want to have a way of completely expressing it and then hopefully.
Good point, yeah. And in some of these conversations about that, the very point came up. Some of the studies that it can be appropriate to even wail or, full grieving and then having almost like our ground state is like well-being. And then when we encounter suffering, we might really feel the pain, but then we come back to this ground state of well-being that we can meet the next suffering being with. I think grief in this case, as the kind of like hindrance to compassion, would be getting really bogged down in an ongoing way. Which is hard. I mean, these things are... This happens, right? So we have these teachings to like notice that and see how it undermines this compassion, which is could be a kind of beautiful feeling of just wishing others to be free from pain. Beautiful, kind of bittersweet, because we feel connected is the beautiful part, but it's not so joyful. So that's one difference between loving kindness is focusing on the positive potential, even if somebody's actually suffering, may they be happy, is loving kindness wish. And it's looking at the positive potential, whereas compassion is a more realistic acknowledgement of the actual suffering right now. So they have a little different flavor, but very, very similar, and I think usually go together, actually. In fact, I think there's one of the classic teachings, I think, even says, when one is there, truly, the other one is too. Almost the same. May all beings be happy, and may all beings be free from suffering. So, may all beings be free from suffering, or discontent, dissatisfaction, dukkha. Then we can actually look at different types of dukkha, I think, are helpful. Well, I find this helpful to look at in terms of compassion. We could say there's these levels of compassion for these three levels of suffering or dukkha. First type of dukkha, let's call it discontent. It's a less loaded term than suffering, because discontent could be just a little bit. May beings be free from discontent. First is the suffering, or the discontent of discontent, or obvious discontent, we could call it. Dukkha, dukkata. And this is like, old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Obvious forms of suffering or discontent. And that's, I think, often what we think of, where we often leave it at that, because it's the obvious one when we think of generating compassion or cultivating compassion for suffering beings. We think of those who are, we know who are sick. We do these well-being ceremonies for those who have a particular, often physical ailment. Maybe we occasionally might do well-being ceremony for for like family of someone who's died. So it's maybe they don't have a physical ailment, but they're suffering mentally. It's more rare though. Almost all our well-being ceremonies are for physical, obvious discontent, dis-ease, suffering. So when we hear about these other types of more subtle suffering, then we might have to do continuous well-being ceremonies for all beings. This is a good one to remember, this, the obvious one. And if we don't, it's nice to just stay in touch with suffering. So that's nice to do well-being ceremonies and the Sangha. There's often somebody who's sick, and it reminds us. There's also, you know, three types of feeling. You maybe heard this teaching in the kind of Abhidharma language. The second skanda, the aspect of being a sentient being, is called feeling or sensation, and has three types: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So these three types of suffering are connected with these. So this one is obviously connected with unpleasant feelings. And we can notice it in ourselves, in others, if we watch the news. I think Thich Nhat Hanh actually, I recall him saying, recommending that people watch the news in order to stay in touch with the suffering of the world, in order to practice giving rise to compassion. So if you're like, oh, everything's cool in Santa Cruz and you know, my life is going well, it's like you just read a paper, turn on TV, and you can very quickly find objects of compassion. So the next type of discontent or suffering is called the suffering due to transformation or change. Sometimes called parinama dukkata, and also sometimes called sukha dukkha, sukha dukkata, which sukha means pleasant, pleasure. So it's the suffering of pleasure. It's the unpleasantness of the pleasant, which you can see what that means when you hear the other name for it is the suffering due to change. Which is less obvious, right? But all conditioned states are impermanent, so pleasure will eventually cease, and displeasure will arise. And sometimes we can even catch it in the middle of pleasure. We just remember that it's going to end, or we're starting to hold on to it, wanting to lengthen it or increase it. And almost, it's kind of, I kind of appreciate that the way that the samsaric world of dependent arising is set up, the way it works, it seems to work, is that around this pleasure and pain thing, is that virtually everything, tell me if you can think of an exception, but everything I can think of that's pleasant, if you have too much of it, it turns unpleasant. If there were some exception to this, then maybe we wouldn't have practice. We wouldn't have spiritual practice or Buddha Dharma or any of this, right? Because we would just have that. We might say, well, maybe there's some things that you could keep taking over and over again, and they would be like keep your pleasure going, but they have side effects, unpleasant side effects. I mean, this is what people might try to do with heroin or something, right? But it will kill them. The displeasure is so extreme, kind of in proportion. Maybe the more pleasure, the counteracting displeasure will be just as strong. Food, sex, coolness when we're hot, jumping in the cold water to cool off, but you stay in there too long, it gets too cold. Warmth when it's cool, now it's getting too hot. there's pleasure, there's temporary pleasures, right? But because they end, if we look closer at them, the more we're aware, I think, of our own experience, the more we just see how even in the pleasure is this kind of seeds of displeasure, which is not to say that we shouldn't fully experience the pleasant, but just be realistic that it's not permanent. I was reading this in the Abhidharma Kosha, which is this huge volume of teaching of all these different topics, right? So it has this whole section, of course, on these three types of suffering, and this big section on kind of debate. It's so detailed, right? The debate is like whether this discontent of pleasure is actually discontent during it, or whether it needs to change first in order for it to be discontent. And there's a whole bunch of arguments on both sides from that old Indian debaters, Vasubandhu in particular. So I'll leave that one open. And then so the three feelings, this type of suffering is connected with pleasant feeling. And the third that's connected with neutral feelings is the suffering or discontent of just being conditioned. It's one way to put it. Samskara dukkata. Samskara means formations. It's the fourth skanda. Literally, it's etymologically, it's like put together. Samskara. Sanskrita is another form of this word, which is the name for that old Indian language, Sanskrit, which means put together, constructed, because language puts together and constructs a world. The name of the language is putting together or constructing. It's kind of neat. So the fact that everything is conditioned, constructed, and therefore not reliable, constantly changing, and uncontrollable, because everything is just arising and ceasing according to conditions. This is the most subtle kind of discontent. And it's said that the first two are like come and go. Sometimes we have the pleasant ones, events, sometimes unpleasant events, but this one is like continuous for sentient beings. Buddhas are free of this one, but sentient beings, this is one we really often don't notice. But sometimes as meditators, I think we can sometimes get a sense of it when we're really quiet and still. Sitting zazen maybe, where it seems like everything is just right, or maybe actually comfortable, there's a cool breeze blowing through, we're maybe even in touch with the fact that it's impermanent, I know it's all coming and going, but that's cool, or just flowing in the midst of it, but then there's this almost inconceivable, this is my kind of take on it, underlying very subtle dis-ease, like, well, but there's like me here. Because for a Buddha, Buddha's physical body is also conditioned, but without that sense of self there, it's just, there isn't this dis-ease with being conditioned, with the body falling apart and things like this. So if the discontent of transience or change is manifests as looking for security by holding on to things, thinking things will be stable and stay the same, security holding on to things or circumstances or people, based on this discontent that they might change, this third type of suffering of conditioning, suffering of self-conditioning, one teacher calls it, is the subtle basis of the other two types of suffering. And it's the constant struggle, maybe very subtle, unconscious, I think often, struggle to establish a fixed self that doesn't really exist. It's the trying to feel secure and real in being me. So I think this is, sometimes we notice this kind of thing. Like I just got kind of like maintain our identity in even subtle forms. It's the subconscious anxiety that fuels all self-centered reactions. So it's kind of a problem, but very hard to see. Another person said, this is actually like, it's a kind of fear. It's an underlying fear, maybe kind of nameless fear. I recall occasional experiences growing up. I don't know how old I was, preteen age, I think, but I remember these fleeting feelings, maybe like when going to sleep at night, kind of like lying awake and having this almost like an insight, I think, a spontaneous shift of perception into something like this that was like kind of realizing, wow, I'm this person here, and like, and my parent, maybe it's the kind of the age when parents start to seem fallible. no longer seems like these people will just protect me no matter what happens. It's more like they're maybe not so reliable either. And nobody can really protect me. And like, what am I supposed to do? And people are going to offer lots of kind help and suggestions of what to do with my life and so on. But actually, I have to take care of it really myself. And maybe it's like a feeling of this kind of fundamental aloneness. Something like that. I can kind of recall the feeling even now. And almost like terror. Temporary terror of like being like a self in a world of separate selves, and like, I mean, I gotta like take care of this life myself, basically. Something like that. Yeah, kind of hard to explain. Maybe you have some sense.
Just that fear or anxiety about being a self also contains some sense that there isn't a self. Is it trying to balance the two?
Or maybe a kind of like in a like a false understanding of a kind of nihilistic understanding of no self. Maybe we might hear about teachings about no self. We might have some experience that something like no self, without understanding the kind of dharmic implications of it, and that could be terrifying. A kind of like maybe existential angst, which might be actually based on maybe none of this is real, and like that could be like a horrifying thought to an existentialist, but the very same thought to a Dharma practitioner could be the like ultimate liberation. So I think there's some subtlety in how we understand it, and there's also context in which we understand it. But from the usual point of view of Buddha Dharma, actually this is almost like the goal, or the one of the main points is to come to see directly, accurately, and experientially that there is no fixed, abiding, independent self in addition to these five skandhas of the body and mind coming and going, and that's like, that insight is the freedom from suffering, actually. So in that case, it's, and the freedom from fear too. But it's a murky territory, because the self that we're looking at that doesn't exist is quite a subtle thing, so that a lot can be said and has been and will be said about
this Could this fear be experienced prior to the Dharmakaya?
Yeah, I think so. Something like that, where we kind of, yeah, we don't have the context for it, so it doesn't seem liberating. Maybe even like a schizophrenic or something might lose their sense of self or identity temporarily, and it's terrifying. And, you know, it's not at all liberating. But it could be that maybe something very similar to their experience, or maybe not, it's hard to know how to compare these things, in a different, you know, with the grounding of the context of practice and how it is that view, illusory view of the independent self is actually what binds us, as he says here. It's the cause of all the other types of suffering. If we come to understand what that means more and more deeply, then it could be that maybe the schizophrenic's insight or vision is actually could be liberating. But there, you know, that's why we have all these practices kind of building up to this insight within the practice. So these three types of discontent or suffering is a nice teaching in and of itself to look at in terms of our own life. But today, these are the three types of suffering that we can have compassion for, because the compassion is the wish for ourselves and all beings to be free from discontent. So, starting with ourselves, which is generally recommended, that we actually apply that compassion. If we're practicing developing compassion, which is a traditional Buddhist practice, often in Zen we don't get into these things because we say just sit and it will all take care of itself. Which, parenthetically, I would say if we're really just sitting, becoming really deeply aware of the workings of our body and mind, I think it may be true. But that's not to say that we can't supplement our just sitting with some kind of intentional looking at suffering and compassionate response. So we start with ourselves. I'd say that's not so, isn't that kind of self-centered? But no, this is compassionate. May this one, and I mentioned this once before, sometimes if we say, may I be happy and free from suffering, we feel uncomfortable. I sometimes feel uncomfortable. When I heard that teaching, I thought, yeah, I relate to that. Because I feel kind of guilty. Well, I don't deserve to be happy. And somehow this thing of I, it's a kind of attachment, that self, actually, I think, in this form of like, I don't deserve it. But if we say, may this one, it's a little bit making it third person, right? It's a little bit, may this person, it's not maybe fixating so much on the me and I, may this person be happy, is cultivating loving kindness towards this person. May this person be free from suffering. May I, you know, I'm like, well, when I would first start telling like my dad about this, when I was so excited learning about this Buddhist teaching, it's like, this is about the end of suffering. Can you believe this? There's actually like a path. And he's like, well, I don't understand what's the, are you suffering? I thought you were a happy boy. And why would I need this? I don't suffer. That's why I like the word discontent, because people feel like I don't suffer. But even discontent is funny, you know. I just visited him and my mom this weekend, and I think it briefly came up maybe the same topic, and I think there's still that sense of feeling like maybe a kind of denial, because we're trying to be happy, so let's not look at the discontent. And also, like, maybe practitioners, or to speak for myself, maybe like I'm the type of person who's almost like obsessed with even like low levels of discontent. I think once we see it more and more, we see like there really is this potential to work with, like, to be really more and more at ease all the time. And then, we're not looking at the gross sufferings as much. And maybe people like my dad are, fortunately, not obsessed with like this low-level discontent. I'm basically happy. I get upset sometimes, but it's okay. That's part of being human. But maybe I'm like, no, we're gonna cut through all of it. I'm very idealistic, right? So, and once we see how it works, we see that basically how this whole thing functions, it really does seem possible. Maybe not likely for me in this life, but I believe it's possible. Just because of how cause and effect work, we see how suffering arises due to this view of the independent self. And it's because there's not truly an independent self, it should be possible to actually like release this view. But in my own experience, it's not like it's kind of like quick and easy kind of thing. Yes?
Really fascinating to me. I think of when you talk about childhood, it seems like classical ideas of child development are that there's a period you were talking about where you start to move away from the sense and comfort of the parent and start to develop a sense of self.
Yeah.
That's actually phase that you must develop.
Must.
At some point, a separate sense of ego and self. So the arc that starts to sound like, well, if we're going to accept our practice as valid, then it's a practice that in normal human development, self and ego first must develop in order for the ego to survive. And then at some point has to be revisited and tempered so that it doesn't ruin our lives with over-habituated, conditioned and constructive.
Yes. An overly reified sense of self.
When does that happen? It's just kind of this interesting arc.
It isn't like an arc, I think so.
Where you're going to have to be unhappy for like adolescence.
Yeah, that's the big one. Yeah. But I don't think it's exactly reverting back to childhood. I mean, maybe in some ways practice is like that and we hear sayings like that. But it seems to me more like there's like a little baby doesn't really have that sense. It develops a healthy development of a sense of self, good, strong development. And I think all spiritual teachers agree you have to go through this phase. And most people maybe never go, it's not an arc, they stop there. But as practitioners, then we can see, start examining with our adult intelligence, which I don't think you could do as a teenager, or at least as a young kid, because it takes some reasoning and actually diligent examination and investigation in a very calm and focused mind to even start to unravel this. But we can do this gradually. And then it's not so much that we remove the sense of self. It's more like now there's just a mere I. There's the functional sense of this person, the collection of five skandhas we can think of as me, where our perception is set up to relate to the world through this body-mind organism. And that doesn't stop. I don't know about how Buddhists work, maybe it's something different. But I think there really can be a completely different shift into not reifying, not believing that that's actually that there's somebody here doing it, even though there's the sense that there kind of is, that we see more and more that it's an illusory sense. So so the arc is not exactly like beginning and end are the same, but something like that. So we can, if we're cultivating opening to compassion towards ourselves, first obvious sufferings, but when we feel like everything's going well, then we can start to look a little deeper at, well, everything's going well, but it's not permanent. We start to get in touch with that and how we might be looking for security by holding on to things being permanent and feeling some dis-ease with that holding on. And then have compassion for that. That's a kind of dis-ease. Then we can, may I be free from this. This too, this type of dis-ease that's actually holding on to stability and security and things staying the same. That's harder, but we can have compassion towards ourselves. You feel that? And then the subtle one, maybe quite hard to even get in touch with it, but if we feel this underlying basic like sense, even when we're just resting calmly in zazen, we can still maybe feel this sense there's somebody here, the meditator doing this, and there's some dis-ease with that, very subtle dis-ease. May this one be free from that subtle dis-ease, that subtle suffering. So we can generate that compassion towards ourselves in these three ways. So there's no end to this type of compassion, right? And it's said that the more we especially get in touch with this third type of discontent, this discontent of just being conditioned, being subject to conditions, for someone who's not in touch with that at all, who's never meditated or looked at that, it's like placing a hair on your hand. You don't even notice it. But for like maybe an advanced meditator, someone who's really been looking at this for a while, that this type of discontent is like a hair in your eye. It's like you're in touch with this type of like subtle unease, and basically it's called like underlying continuous samsara, right? And so the only way to remove this hair is nirvana. Yeah, this is like the early teachings. Or another image is for someone who's really in touch with this suffering, the highest heaven realms are more painful than the lowest hell realms for an ordinary non-meditator. So if we're wondering like how much we're in touch with with this type of suffering, these are some clues, which isn't very much incentive to get in touch with it, right? It's like we'll be constantly in like a hell realm if we're really in touch with that, how this is. But I think this is maybe part of like, maybe goes along with bodhicitta even, is getting in touch with this underlying misperception of everything continuously, as an incentive to, if there were no way to be free from it, then it would just be like pointless. We wouldn't want to hear about it. But the good news is the Buddha offers these examinations into what's happening, and then says, but actually, there is cessation of discontent, and there's a path. So this is maybe another like arc of like we start off basically kind of okay, and the more we get into practice, the more we start to see all these problems. Maybe everyone has some experience of that. I know I do. Like, and I don't think we're actually having less problems, but we're just more aware of the subtle ones. So it seems worse and worse and worse, but if we keep going with it, then we maybe start to let go of some stuff, and we maybe end up actually not really where we started, but maybe feeling more like, you know, because where we started was like a hair on the hand, and now we're like we've actually removed the hair from the eye maybe at the end, and it's, so it might seem like they're both content, but actually this is really content. So we can have these three types of compassion for ourselves, and then we can, just with loving kindness to review, we can direct it towards, you know, start with easy people, our kind benefactors, our loved ones, may they be free from suffering. Even when they're blissed out, we can see in them now, right? These seeds of, oh, but it's not going to last. Or we can see, but they're a conditioned being. And we can generate that kind of compassion. And then we move on towards, acquaintances and then neutral people at the checkout counter at the supermarket that we don't know. And I think this is why I think it's nice to look into these three types of discontent, because the person at the checkout counter, hey, how you doing? They're like, they're in the groove. They're like, well, they don't seem suffering. But then we look at them with this deeper vision. Oh, I'm so sorry. They're not even aware of it, this underlying dis-ease, this existential angst as they're falling asleep, maybe. Or maybe even if they're not in touch with it at all, maybe even worse, because then then they probably never look for a way out. And just keep cycling through, not quite fully free. And then we're directed towards difficult people, up to the people we really have a hard time appreciating. And gradually. And then all beings throughout space and time. And therefore, it's said that this wisdom, these are kind of wisdom teachings, examining like this underlying sense of independent self and conditionality. Looking into these wisdom teachings actually increases compassion. Because the people that we thought, well, I don't really have compassion for those people because they seem always happy. Now we see, oh, actually, I know they're like me. Also, these wisdom teachings, the more we see it in ourselves, which is what we should study the self, right? The more we see it in ourselves, the more it becomes very clear that this is the same for all sentient beings, humans and animals and all beings. So, we see a world of discontent, and therefore we can have it may be possible to start opening to this more and more deeper compassion for all these happy beings, as well as, of course, the obviously suffering ones. So with wisdom deepens compassion because we see that our situation applies to others. It's part of wisdom. We see this root underlying causes of suffering are the same for all beings. And we see, oh, it's so pervading even when it doesn't look like suffering. So there also wisdom increases compassion. And we have to always remember that there is a path to this freedom. So it's not like a hopeless situation. I think if it was actually hopeless, if anybody suffering was truly hopeless, I think we actually couldn't really have compassion, right? Because the compassion is the wish for them to be free from suffering. If they couldn't be free from suffering, we couldn't really have the wish. So we need this, maybe for this, to have compassion for maybe terminally ill people or painfully dying and being tortured with no hope at all. If we have this vast scale, vast view that of many, many lifetimes of potentially evolving through this messy situation, then we really can. May this tortured person about to die, may they eventually be completely free from all traces of suffering. A bittersweet, bittersweet feeling. So, as usual, I can't stop yakking. So, people got to ask some questions along the way, I'm glad. Always feel free to interrupt me. Anything that feels essential to bring up to end here. Yes.
Well, I think of compassion as feeling with another person
in
their suffering, not wishing for, of course you'd like your suffering, but more, it may not end.
There's the empathy. There's the empathy, which is really being with, and partly due to these contemplations of what suffering is, we really are. When I start thinking about it that way, I feel actually more intimate with all of you and everyone. Like we're all in the same boat of this crazy situation of like this illusory life that, that with all the dials are turned to like, this is totally real what we think is happening. We feel like we're all in this and it's painful on and off. And, but so compassion, you know, in English means to suffer with, but, that's part of the classic Buddhist definitions from, I think, the Pali Canon originally are actually, both loving kindness and compassion are actually this wish. So they are total empathy, being with beings in their joy and their sorrow, with also this wish that they be free. And maybe like, so somebody who's basically not going to get better in this life or not, they're in continuous pain and we know it's not going to end, we can still have that wish, I think, either for the long future of eternity or even for this life. May they find some ease. May they find some ease, any ease. Like may they have just appreciate their last meal, you know, before they die. So that is compassion. But then, you know, Maha Karuna in the sutras is the Buddha's great compassion. And this is actually the wish that all sentient beings, not just humans and animals, but hungry ghosts and all different realms of beings, be completely free from all these three types of discontent. So that kind of entails the story of cycling through many, many lives. Because in that version, somebody maybe have a really unpleasant life this time around, but eventually may they evolve to be a Buddha. Is the only one really completely free from all discontent. May all beings be Buddhas. And then there's the bodhicitta part of, may I help them to do that. It's ridiculously awesome. So just the last little tiny story I'll leave us with from Dongshan, the record of Dongshan. Here's one story where you probably heard where a monk asks, what's the most painful thing? Or Dongshan asks the monk, what's the most painful thing? And the monk says, hell, lowest hell is the most painful thing. And Dongshan says, nope, it's to wear this robe and not have clarified the great matter. That's the most painful thing. So I think that's addressing this third type of discontent. Like we're on the path, we've heard these teachings, but it's so, our habitual tendencies are so strong. We haven't finished this work. We're on the path, and we can't do it. This is most painful. But the one I wanted to bring up was, about the one time Dongshan was washing his bowls, I guess outside, when he saw two birds contending over a frog. I guess they like maybe two birds trying to attack and eat the frog. And a monk was standing with him and saw this and said, why does it come to this? Kind of like, so much suffering, it's just like built in to this movie. Why does it come to this? And Dongshan said, it's only for your benefit. venerable. So this is another way to see anytime we encounter suffering in ourselves or others, may we use it to examine what is this and to generate compassion. It's not the most cheerful topic, but I feel like it's getting real. And I think it's unraveling this potential of great freedom and joy, even in compassion itself. We've been sitting a long time. Please take care. May any positive energy generated this evening be directed towards all sentient beings in all realms with all types of discontent. May it ease their pain, even just a little. May they be free. May all beings be happy, have the causes of happiness, be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.